I'd been perfected in Brooklyn Boxing Gym since I was a teenager. He crumpled to the ground. By the time my brother recovered and turned around, his assailant was already laid out, with me on top of him. My adrenaline spiked into the stratosphere and the hand I had punched him with was already swelling up like a balloon. I didn't want to continue the battle because instinct told me to put a quick end to the whole situation. The fight had gone down like nothing in the movies. Nobody won. "Don't hit him again," Max hissed. Then the camera swooped in, with the Kiev equivalent of paparazzi exploding flashbulbs in our faces. The next day, a picture of me pinning the boyfriend down was splashed all over the Ukrainian newspapers. The caption read, "The Chmerkovsky brothers, just over from America for a day, in a brawl." In the spirit of my habitual Valiant overanalysis, I'd say my relationship with Max shifted right there, at least in my own mind. "Now we're even," I remember thinking. "You looked out for me and had my back my whole life." Now, when the shit hit the fan, I did not hesitate. I did not think twice. It was as if I was at last ready to say to Max, "Yo, I'm never gonna stop caring about you or loving you or doing things for you, but it will never again come from a place of owing you or of look how much my brother's done for me. Now I've done just as much for you as you've done for me." And that was a proud moment. I grew up around people who were hustling all the time to provide for me, and I felt an overwhelming urge to return the favor, to give back as good as I had received. Max had been such an immense force in my life. I was a product of his teaching, so my return on his investment in me was my winning dance competitions. I might have been the racehorse, but I wouldn't have a stable, I wouldn't have food, I wouldn't have anything if it weren't for his teaching. Somewhere in my brain, I had formulated the definition of the alpha man as someone who paid his debt to whoever helped him along on the road of life. If he can't pay them back personally, he pays it forward in his attitude toward others. I always felt the impulse to even the scales. That single episode, with me coming in and protecting Max for a change, might have been the moment when he finally understood an essential truth. He could hear himself say the same words that I always had running through my own mind. "I have a brother who would go to the mat for me. I have a brother who's looking out for me. I have a brother who will be there. Put it on my tab, Max." Leaving. I can nail down the exact moment it happened, when I decided to leave the competitive dance world, where for over a decade, I had found my home, my inspiration, and really my whole reason for being. I was in Blackpool, England in 2011 for the British Open Latin Dance Championship, right in the middle of a samba. The field had been winnowed from hundreds down to the top 48, with my partner Daria, Dasha Chesnokova, and me cruising toward the finals. We had danced a couple of rounds now and I was getting into my groove. At that point in my career, I was no longer the dark horse, the up-and-comer. Instead, I was a recognized favorite. The scorekeepers called, scrutineers had tallied the points for each round, and the standings were already clear. In a huge competition such as Blackpool, the judges didn't necessarily assess every single couple out on that floor. How could they? Within the space of a few minutes, it would be impossible to focus on every dancer. No, what happened was the team of judges understood which favorites were likely to pass through to the next round. Dasha and I knew that when the round of 48 couples was judged and the number of couples halved to the top 24, we would be among those still standing. I was dancing and we were killing it. In the samba, a moving dance, dancers travel counterclockwise and the traffic on the dance floor just flows. By contrast, the Paso Doble is more of a march, while the cha-cha and the jive are more stationary. We would choose our positions and remain in a fairly limited area. In movement dances like the samba or the waltz, the dancers are like the cars in a NASCAR race, with couples constantly maneuvering around in a crowd. We were on the inside track and covered up, hidden from the judges and spectators by a screen of other dancers. No one except the other dancers could really see us, but it didn't matter, because Dasha and I had probably been marked as favorites before we even started dancing. But then my pride kicked in. Favorite or not, I didn't want to be lost in the crowd. I wanted to connect to the audience and feel the inspiration flow from them to me. I've been in the same position before, traffic-wise. The situation can lend an airless feeling to the proceedings. If I wasn't creating beautiful art for the audience to see and the judges to mark, why was I there? I was dancing a promenade run into a volta, another volta and then a slow volta, whereby my partner and I would wind up facing each other. And during that precise combination, I remember thinking, promenade run. And then immediately came a second thought, what the fuck am I doing? That was the question posed in my mind. What is this movement and why am I doing it? It suddenly occurred to me that I had been performing the same movement for more than 15 years, fine-tuning the same step, and beyond that, dancing the same five Latin dances in the same order, cha-cha, samba, rumba, paso doble, jab, cha-cha, samba, rumba, paso doble, jab. It was odd and at the same time meaningful to me that I would manage to have a conversation with myself while in the middle of a competition. It meant that I wasn't in the moment, wasn't connecting with my partner, and wasn't connected to the opportunity. The Black Bull Dance Festival, the dance world's most celebrated event. In the grandest terms, I wasn't connecting to the universe. I was only connecting with myself. What are you doing? My interior voice asked. Why are you doing this? Again, why? The question, why, hung in my mind and wouldn't go away. My answer? I'm pursuing this for reasons of pride only. Then my pride spoke up. Yo, we're good. It sounded crazy, but that was how it played out in my head. We're good here, said pride. I'm so proud of you. At that moment, pride had taken on a Mr. Rogers kind of tone. But you've got this other shit to do. You know, go do it. Stop trying to satisfy me, because I'm proud of you. You've had a long career, 19 years, all told, almost 2 decades. My mind flashed back through my partners, my friends, my teachers, my mentors, my coaches, moms and pops and Max and everyone else, the lessons, the competitions, Blackpool, Palm Beach, Moscow, Italy. I was nothing but a dead broke dancer. How could I have hit all these wonderful places? Some wealthy dude I'd run into would be nattering on about spending time in Capri, and I could say, oh, yeah, dope, I'd spend time in Ischia. What? How did you possibly manage that? During my competitive career, I always kept 3 responsibilities firmly in mind. To myself, to others, and to the art of dancing itself. That was my holy trinity. I never wanted to be a part of something where I wasn't giving my everything to all 3. If I didn't take care of my responsibility to myself, then I was destined to fail with the other 2. And at that precise moment during the samba at Blackpool, I knew I wasn't being true to my number 1. It was the oxygen mask situation on an airplane. Be sure to put your own mask on before you try to help anyone else. You can't do anyone any good if you pass out. For the first time in my entire life, I had been taking dance for granted. I knew I would be marked to advance to the next round, so I was just going through the motions. But without heart, my dance was empty. It was nothing. Finally, my pride gave me permission to let go. All this happened in a frozen second, in the midst of that one volta. Dasha and I took 3rd in Blackpool that year, but I thought that we should have been 5th, and the guy who was 12th should have been 3rd, and the couple who was 1st should have been like 13th or something. But I understood that wasn't how things worked. Don't hate the player, hate the game. As I left Blackpool, I remember feeling such love and affection for every single person on that floor. Really for everyone in the world of competitive dance, doubling down on the emotion, because I knew I would be leaving them. 1,000 thoughts whirled around in my head. I was writing a lot of rap and poetry at the time, and I had fantasies of pouring all my energies into a music career. I really thought I could do it, and I still think I could. I haven't found my sound yet. Or maybe I'll make one last desperation run at a career in the NBA. And if I missed competitive dance, I hadn't burned any bridges or slammed shut any doors. I was younger than most of the current champions. I could take off for 3 years and still come back in my prime. That's what I thought. Right at that moment, though, I simply didn't want to hold that train anymore. I texted Max. Bro, I think I'm done competing. my dear brother, bless his heart. I had told the same thing many times, 6 years before, 5 years, 3 years, out of frustration with this or that situation, and he always responded with encouragement to keep at it. Well, this time, lo and behold, Max replied simply and differently. Bro, it's about time. The Dancing with the Stars folks had been contacting me off and on over the years, peppering me with invitations, either through Max or face-to-face whenever I was in LA, wanting me to join the show. With my focus on the competition world, I always politely put them off. The show was Max's thing, I thought. My thing was Blackpool, the German Open, international championships. Of course, since my brother had been my first and by far my most influential teacher, my thing was Max's thing, too. I was proof positive of his genius as a mentor. Do you think they're still interested in me at Dancing with the Stars? I texted. I don't know, he texted back. Let me text them and ask. Text them? Okay, all right, let me call them. I still had to break the news to my partner. We were already committed to a competition in Shenzhen, China, outside of Hong Kong. I couldn't refuse to go to that, but otherwise, I had to tell her we were finished. The whole business was complicated by the fact that my family had basically rescued Dasha from a shitty, going-nowhere situation in Ukraine. I had reached out and asked her to dance as my partner, and the next day she was on a plane to the States. It was as if she jumped from literally high school and got drafted straight into the NBA. Plus, she quite literally found a new home with us, moving in with my parents in New Jersey. Now, our run was ending. Dasha, I think I'm done competing, I said. I think China's gonna be it for me. She was heartbroken. She started crying. Her life as a competitive dancer was just beginning. But her first thought wasn't even about that. She needed parents. She needed family. Can I still live with you guys? Jesus, of course yes, I said, heartbroken myself by the question. I stumbled trying to reassure her, but the words tumbled out. Yes, yes, you are not, you know, this isn't a breakup. We don't have a business arrangement, okay? We have a people arrangement. We're still people, and we love you, and we still love you, and no way we're ever going to turn our backs on you. The tears kept coming. Sniffle, sniffle. Weep, weep. Much more of this, and I was going to cry myself. Competing together or not, I still want to see you succeed. Sniffle, sniffle. Hey, do you want to maybe come with me to Dancing with the Stars? Maybe you want to do that? Dasha's English wasn't that good, so the producers probably weren't going to consider her for a position as a pro and give her a celebrity partner. But there was always the show's dance troupe. And she did later join the show as a troupe dancer, which kind of put a band-aid on the wound of me leaving her as a partner. Eventually, Dasha also went back to competition, but she lived with my parents in Jersey for about a year and a half after that, until she got her bearings and was ready to make a go of it on her own. She went on to be ranked number 2 in the world. Beyond my partner, I still had one more person to tell of my decision to leave competition, and this was a conversation I dreaded most of all. I had to inform my dad. I went to him like a man, and we had something of a heart-to-heart about it. By the expression on his face, I could read the heartbreak he was feeling. More than anyone else, even more than Max or my mom, my father lived that whole competition life through me. He had been at my side throughout. The image of him proudly waving the stars and stripes at the 2001 Junior Worlds remained fresh in my mind. The conversation we had marked the beginning of a transformation in our relationship. It was the Chmerkovsky family equivalent of the moment many kids have at 18 or 19 when they leave the nest to head off to college. Just like most parents in that situation, my dad was sad and proud at the same time. Well, he said, finally you're sticking up for yourself. At that moment, I loved his response more than anything in the world. It was as if his words made me realize the door of the cage had been left open and I was free to fly. Ashley Edens and Joe Sunker, two producers on Dancing with the Stars, called me, both of them on the phone at once. We'd love to have you, Ashley said. It'll be an incredible season, Joe added. Cool, I said. When do I come in? In August. August 18th, they replied, talking over each other. My whole life has been an audition, but this time I didn't have to try out or show my chops or impress the gatekeepers. I didn't have to find an agent. I didn't hire a manager. I didn't even have to kiss too much ass. My victories on the ballroom circuit spoke for me. I was 25 and I was going to Hollywood. Leaving the field of competition usually involves an announcement at a dancer's final event, an opportunity to be feted, petted, and praised. You get on the mic and you say your thank yous. My last competition was off the usual circuit in China, so any sort of formal leave-taking wasn't in the cards. Dasha and I won, and we were invited to perform the last unjudged honor dance that was traditionally awarded to champions. I danced my final dance without anybody in the audience realizing that it was my final dance. It was a special moment. The only ones present who understood what was happening were three couples in the competition who were my friends. They knew, and they were all bawling. Still, the occasion wasn't the ceremonial public goodbye that retiring dancers customarily made. Instead, that summer I sent a semi-official letter to Dance Beat magazine, then the leading media outlet for the ballroom world. I needed closure. I wasn't just going to bounce and not say my thank yous. I tried to use the announcement as a lever for change in the world of ballroom competition, which was then tangled in bureaucracy and red tape. As in boxing, where there are no undisputed champions anymore, with separate belts awarded by the WBO, WBA, WBC, and the IBF, ballroom had split into competing federations as well. I bemoaned the impact the split had upon the lives of dancers. I emphasized how hard it was to be a ballroom dancer on the competition circuit. For years, my inspiration arose from the community, from the opportunity to be able to compete against the best in the world. None of us were doing it for the money, because there wasn't any. Now, with the flurry of sanctions and the competing organizations, the only incentive we ever had was being diminished. A stupid bureaucratic clause meant that I could not compete against Nino Langella, for example. My letter was a plea from the ranks. Within the small, cloistered community of ballroom dancing, the news broke huge and the buzz was crazy. I fielded dozens of calls from all over the world. A few dance blogs that were popping up at the time reposted the letter, and suddenly it was all over the internet, translated into 6 different languages. It was as though I had offered myself up as a martyr to the cause. The fight to make life easier for the poor, beleaguered dancers competing in the thankless, moneyless competition world. The activist call for change actually ignited a movement, resulting in a realignment of the competitive circuit. In the final paragraph, I sounded a valedictory note. I am who I am because of dance, music, and self-expression. I will continue on my journey of self-enlightenment through dance, music, and self-expression. But it will be through different avenues. I will forever champion the principles I acquired through the world of ballroom dancing. I will forever be grateful for the memories I was so fortunate to have. I walk away from competition a humbled man, a grateful man, but most importantly, an inspired one. I'm inspired to reach new heights and pinnacles in my future endeavors. However, I will never forget the world that raised me and shaped me into the man I am today. Enough said. In August 2011, I moved into a rented house in the hills of West Hollywood, sharing it with Max, Dasha, and Teddy Volinets, Jana's kid, who was also a member of the Dancing with the Stars troupe for season 13. We lived just a couple of blocks up from the Viper Room, Whiskey a Go-Go, and the rest of the clubs that made Sunset Strip the most crowded stretch of crazy in L.A. I didn't go Hollywood so much as I jammed locally on the strip. For a hot second that summer, I seized the opportunity to be a rock star. Los Angeles had the most beautiful people in the world, at least aesthetically. Intellectually, not always. They're like the weather, gorgeous and warm, and just a tad bit boring. Every once in a while, I would feel myself missing the street life in Brooklyn, remembering the lines from one of Neil Simon's plays, "When it's 100 degrees in New York, it's 72 in Los Angeles. When it's 30 degrees in New York, in Los Angeles it's still 72. However, there are 6 million interesting people in New York, and only 72 in Los Angeles. When there was fantasy involved, reality got suspended. People in LA were caught up in a dream world. There was nothing more addicting than the Hollywood fantasy, because in a fantasy, anything was possible. During those few days in Los Angeles, I indulged in frantic waves of partying, letting myself go because I was experiencing such a sense of release on leaving the world of competition. But in the back of my mind, I heard a whisper, "Don't make the fantasy your whole world. Stay present. Stay focused." I was on a mission. I had just made a big statement retiring from competition and preventing the ballroom world with all my righteous shit in the dance beat letter. Now it was time to put my money where my mouth was. Okay. Okay, big shot, with the big ideas. You sold us all on your big deal vision. Now let's see how it all plays out. When the time came, I brushed the party cobwebs from my brain and headed down the hill to a soundstage on Beverly Boulevard, where I would take my place as a professional dancer on Dancing with the Stars. Part 5. A Journey in Dance. 2 Pair. 11 seasons as a professional dancer now, I was finally going into Dancing with the Stars not as a rookie, not as a newbie. After my triumph with Rumor, I was the reigning champion, a status I never had before. For my partner, first meeting on season 21, I drove north of LA to the fancy suburb of Calabasas. The casting director gave me an address, but of course didn't inform me whose house I was headed toward. The gated community featured yellow hillsides of parched grass and a collection of huge, very fancy residences. It was a neighborhood I had no business being in, but I felt not too out of place because I was driving a BMW 6 Series. Max had challenged me to buy it. "I don't need anything like that, bro," I told him as we scoped out the awesome vehicle online. "Don't be such a little bitch," he said. "You got the money now. Go ahead. Get something of value. You'd rather be hauling your ass around in an economy compact?" In the back of my mind, the answer was a resounding yes, but I caved in anyway. I have to say, I didn't get much more pleasure from driving a luxury vehicle than I did from the clunker Hondas and Fords that I had owned in the past. The car mania of California, where it was really important to people what car you drove, was totally lost on me. I passed Kim Kardashian's house, one of them anyway, Dr. Dre's place, then a series of monster real-deal mansions that looked like fortresses. At the very top of one of the hills was the fanciest house in the community. Just a beautiful, beautiful home. But I was only the help come to call, so I wasn't ushered into the main house. Instead, I was directed to one of the two guest houses on the property, which were large residences on their own terms. There, I met Tamar Braxton, the singer, the TV personality, actress, a one-woman force of nature, vibrant, loud, and dynamic. She was the kind of person who becomes your friend as soon as you shake her hand. We hit it off immediately, starting a comfortable back-and-forth banter that stuck with us the whole time we were together. She called me pal. Maybe she misheard my name. She repeated personal catchphrases such as, "You tried it. You tried it." She quickly realized that I wasn't the ballroom dancing white boy she'd expected. She found out that I had more soul and more hip-hop in me than her little privileged ass had ever experienced on the planet. But she's still fucking Tamar Braxton. She's still the youngest sibling of the fabulous Braxton family, and that's where she had it all over me. She was also stretched way too thin. I kept a mental tab as we spoke, and I counted 5 gigs she was juggling in addition to Dancing with the Stars. Hosting a Fox Network talk show called The Real, starring in a reality show about her personal life, Tamar and Vince, promoting a new album, Calling All Lovers, releasing another album of Christmas theme songs that she was doing with her sisters Tony, Tracy, Trina, and Tawanda, plus random singles, music videos, and guest appearances. I felt dizzy trying to keep track of it all. She'd been on the show business map a long time, and I don't think she's ever been broke. But she met her match in me, and we had the best time that season. Odd couple that we were, on some deep down level, we were identical twins. She had a lot of potential, a lot of talent, a lot of sass, and she was a star, which meant she could carry off pretty much any performance and make it look effortless. Every time we got together, she gave me everything she had. Unfortunately, there were times when she just didn't have anything left to give. Our schedule was insane, even by early 21st century standards, when multitasking turned crazy. She was promoting singles from her new album, and I was always flying all over the country to meet her at this venue or that. The rehearsal process was difficult for her, and we never had enough time. We had to catch dance sessions when we could, in hotel lobbies on hallway carpets, like dancing in mud when compared to parquet, or green rooms of concert halls. In the course of working with her, I became a professional lobby rehearser. In a car, a warning light tells you that you need gas. You ignore it, and the gauge falls down to empty, but you still ignore it and ride on fumes for another 10 miles. Sooner or later, though, there's going to be nothing left in the tank. Tamar's low gas warning light had been on for a long time. During our Dancing with the Stars appearances, we had a series of great moments. The highlight of the season came in week 6 when we scored a perfect 30 on a Janet Jackson routine centered around the album Rhythm Nation. Since Janet was Tamar's idol, in a lot of ways, the tribute had a deeply personal meaning for her. Tamar was definitely one of the more vocal contestants on the show. I was able to handle it, but I'm not sure the audience could. A lot of times, people react to strong characters with their own strong, outspoken comments, especially on social media. We made the quarterfinals on the show, then flew to Vegas where Tamar had a concert. Next, she went to Atlanta, and I met her there. She was clearly exhausted when we headed to set on the next Monday and taped from 6 in the morning until 11 that night. We finished our dance early at the dress rehearsal, and I could see she was about to pass out. Her eyes were just swimming around in her head like marbles. "Oh man, Tamar, you don't look so good." "You tried it," she responded automatically. But her husband, Vince, noticed her condition too. He jumped up to take command of the situation. "I gotta take her to the hospital." At Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, doctors hooked her up to an IV and began running different blood tests, but the results weren't instantly available yet. She wasn't an athlete, and she wasn't in her 20s, and in the end, her health just caught up with her. She hadn't had a stroke, we knew that fairly quickly, but certainly other conditions that could still be life-threatening hadn't been ruled out. It was an extraordinary situation, like nothing I had ever experienced before. As difficult as the process can be, none of what happened was the show's fault, because none of it could have been predicted. Dancing with the Stars was set to go live at 5 o'clock. It aired at 8 on the East Coast, but in LA we were live at 5. We had 2 dances for that week 9 episode, a solo contemporary to Chris Isaak's Wicked Game, and then a group dance to Hey Jude. The episode ran through the other couples and then came to our slot. With me standing there alone like an idiot, host Tom Bergeron conducted an interview on camera. "Where's your partner?" "My partner's in the hospital because she almost passed out during dress rehearsal." "The judges will stay tuned to what is happening at the hospital," Tom announced. "But here's footage of Tamar and Val from dress rehearsal today." The rule was that if you couldn't dance in the actual show because of an injury, the producers would play rehearsal footage, and the couple got judged on that. I could see from the dress rehearsal recording that Tamar had been close to fainting the entire time she was dancing. The footage sucked, but I didn't care anymore about what was happening on the show. As competitive as I was and as serious and committed as I was to my craft, her health was my number one priority. Maybe I had changed. Maybe I had grown up a little, or maybe my Mirror Bowl win had taken the edge off. But for once, I didn't care about the competition. I just wanted to make sure my partner was all right. Across town at the hospital, though, Tamar had been battling it out with her husband and doctors, insisting she was well enough to hit a TV dance contest being shot a dozen blocks away. This wasn't the Grammys. This was a ballroom dance competition with a partner she met 2 months ago. She probably thought she would never be this invested into this process. She had joined the show to have a good time and learn a little something, but she had grown into her commitment until now here she was, literally putting her life on the line. How far she was willing to go was absolutely incredible to me. There was no rehearsal footage of our second routine. If she didn't make it back to the set that day, we would be eliminated. I'm not going to let Val down, not after all we've been through. She finally decided to go against doctor's orders, got into her car, and headed the mile down Beverly Boulevard to the studio. Our scheduled second number was coming up, and the clock was still ticking. She quickly slipped into a dress, slapped on some makeup, and tied her hair back, all the while barely seeing what was in front of her. She wobbled out toward the parquet as the stage manager counted down the seconds. 5, 4, 3. And suddenly there she was, much the worse for wear, maybe, but present nonetheless. Part of me was saying, this is stupid and ridiculous. But another part of me was so proud that he was a true teammate and a friend for life. We did the rumba number, one that she hadn't even had time to fully learn yet. I led her through the entire routine and she just followed, as if she had been doing it for years. We finished and she took her seat, where fellow celebrity contestant Nick Carter, formerly of the Backstreet Boys, sat next to her, holding her upright. Nick's pro partner, Sharna Burgess, and I stood behind them, all of us in shock about what we had just witnessed. Tamar's eyes were rolling around in her head again, and she was about to pass out on live television. The marks are in, Tamar, Tom announced. The results are in, and both you and Nick are in the semifinals. The audience erupted in cheers. The whole place went nuts. What just happened? Tamar whispered. I gave her a hug. I don't understand. I'm still about to pass out, she said. The show went into a commercial break, and Tamar went straight back to the hospital. There, doctors discovered she had a burst of blood clots, a very serious condition. The dance we just had done featured jumps, lifts, and runs, moves which could have had serious consequences for Tamar's health. If just one clot gets into your heart, it could be a wrap for you, the doctor informed her, telling it like it was. What don't you understand about this? You cannot continue in this competition. I remember when she broke the news to me. I came to visit while she was still in the hospital. You tried it, I said. We both laughed, but we were so proud. I was proud of her, and most importantly, she was proud of herself. What a trooper. In fact, Tamar Braxton proved herself that day to be what I consider a great teammate. Dancing with the Stars was an ABC show, so we naturally did all our premieres, cast reveals, and finale events on the network's hit flagship show, Good Morning America, which everyone knew as GMA. From the very start, I wanted to fit in on the GMA set, wanted it to be like home to me the same way it was for my brother. When he showed up on the show's production facility in Times Square, he was treated like an old friend. I loved the fact that host Robin Roberts would greet him with, "Hey, damn, Max, you look good." It was actually through Robin that I became a member of the GMA family. Our friendship began the year before I became a pro on Dancing with the Stars. As part of the celebration of her 50th birthday in 2010, Robin made a running riff out of ticking off items on her bucket list. Things she wanted to do before she kicked the bucket. Dance with Max Schmerkowski was one of the entries, a fantasy she had evidently nursed for a long time. My brother was, of course, game, but Robin didn't consider herself a natural dancer, so she felt she needed to take a few lessons beforehand. I was the obvious candidate for a dance teacher because I was nearby, on the East Coast, and working as a coach and instructor at our Dance With Me social dance studio in Soho. It was nothing much, just a half dozen sessions, but Robin proved such a warm and engaging person that we bonded instantly. Back then, I wasn't by any means a known entity, having made only a few appearances on Dancing with the Stars for dance-offs or routines with my brother. I wasn't a fan favorite, and no one gravitated to me because of my TV popularity. During the in-between period before I signed on as a pro, I found the whole Dancing with the Stars scene difficult to navigate. That world was very well stocked with really flashy go-getter personalities, people who had aggressive ways of establishing their spheres of influence. At times, the show set in West Hollywood seemed to me to be where a pack of wild dogs peed to mark their territory. I thought that kind of shit was foul and wanted to tell people to go pee in their own corners, not in the commons where we all were supposed to coexist. Even beyond that, they also all knew each other. And here I was, a newbie, with a kid brother reputation to live down. Max flew to New York to dance on GMA with the birthday girl. The routine they did was nothing fancy. She wore a leopard print dress and Max wore jeans, but the other hosts gathered around to act as judges, and a fun, goofy time was had by all. The paddles that the judges held up offered only one possible score, 10. The time spent rehearsing with Robin allowed me to feel a little more like an insider than I had before, both in the world of GMA, but also in the TV community that existed around it. So I got to know Robin, but I wanted more. With GMA, I always had this fantasy of me coming into Times Square Studio and being recognized and welcomed. The image floating in my head had me glad-handing my way through the staff. Hey, what's up, Lara? Hey, George, how are you? Being from New York, the Times Square GMA studio was like a landmark to me. This wasn't some soundstage in Hollywood, though those were pretty cool too. This was like holy ground, a studio right next to the Dow ticker, the News Zipper, where they held the biggest New Year's Eve celebration in the world. This was Robin Roberts and George Papadopoulos, faces of every single one of my mornings growing up. They were interesting people, and like always, I just wanted to connect and have conversations with people who I respected on a very high level. Fast forward to the spring of 2016, when I finally had a chance to realize my fantasies. In March of that year, the cast of the upcoming season 22 of Dancing with the Stars was announced on GMA. The audience and staffers went crazy with applause when it was revealed that I had been matched with the GMA favorite, Ginger Z, the show's in-house meteorologist. Through that alliance, I not only made a friend for life, but was granted the keys to the inner sanctum at GMA. I got to know the sound techs and the grips, the camera operators, and the other hosts. That's the level of friendship I have with GMA now, after my Dancing with the Stars season with Ginger. And an awesome season it was. I was just coming off of a show that ended with my partner checked into a hospital. Thankfully, the situation sorted itself out without any serious repercussions, but it still served as something like a reality check for me. After my season with Tamar, I had to step my game up to another level. I realized that not every dance partner would be a 25-year-old Rumor Willis, someone who I could push physically, mentally, and emotionally to be all that she could be. Going forward, I would have to learn to make accommodations for partners who were mothers, wives, and other adult women who had a lot going on in their lives beyond Dancing with the Stars. Husbands were part of the equation now, and I had to consider the natural, instinctive reaction a husband might have seeing another man fully in his wife's business. I was never physically disrespectful, always mindful and classy, but that didn't mask the fact that I would be holding another man's wife 5 hours a day, every day, for 3 months. My partners and I sweated blood during rehearsals in order to create art every Monday night. That sort of experience brings people together at a very tight level. When my partner happened to be a 20-something girl from Hollywood, she'd fall in love. But with a grown-up mother and a wife, the relationship had to be compartmentalized. She might fall a little, but she had to go back to her real home and real love afterward. The situation itself tended to bring out the green-eyed monster of jealousy. A husband might ask his wife, "What are you so in love with? I'm right here. And you're in love with your tango? Are you in love with your tango, or are you in love with your dance partner?" That's the dynamic I had to keep firmly in mind, that no, this grown-up woman next to me, who had her own adult life and loves and family, she wasn't falling in love with me. She was in love with the process, with the prospect of winning the Mirror Ball, with the whole intense circus of Dancing with the Stars. So before every rehearsal period, I asked myself what kind of season this was going to be. What kind of dance instructor would I become? I needed to be a little bit more mindful, adjust my methods a bit more carefully, and fit my style into the lifestyle of my partner. The old distinction between lessons at Rising Stars Dance Academy and those at our Dance With Me studios served me well. One was a boot camp style affair where we prepared young souls for the world of competition, and the teaching was very much hardcore and authoritarian. Do this. Don't do this. Shut up about it. The other was a grown-up social affair, softer, warmer, more a case of, what would you like to do? One was tailored to children, the other to adults. With Ginger Z, I knew immediately that I had a partner who was very much an adult. She was a mother of a newborn son, just 6 weeks old. She had joined the show a month and a half after giving birth. It was as if her placenta had just dropped and the umbilical cord was still pretty much intact. She was one of the coolest people I had ever met, and if we had met 10 years earlier, in a different life, in a different circumstance, I would have probably married her. As it was, we developed a great friendship that never once strayed into the romantic. I got a contact high seeing this young couple, Ginger and her husband, Ben Aaron, still practically newlyweds, riding the euphoria of having their first child. I became the really cool fifth wheel on their baby stroller. Ginger did Dancing with the Stars to help her rebuild her body after the atom bomb impact of pregnancy. But I had to ask myself, was it too soon? The physical part of the process was hard for her, and meanwhile she was still working as a meteorologist on GMA. For all that, I was overjoyed to once again be able to spend a rehearsal period in my city, the first time since I was paired with Sherry Shepherd during season 13. It was spring, and if there is any place better to be in springtime than Manhattan, I don't know about it. Keep your Aprils in Paris. I'll take a day in May strolling down a street in the village. New York had become even more of my town during that period, because the family had opened a Dance With Me studio in Soho, the trendiest and the high-endiest of all high-end neighborhoods in Manhattan. It served as a signal that Chmerkovsky ambition had fully realized its American dream. I could walk on a sidewalk crowded with thousands of interesting people, head into the rehearsal studio, hit the parquet, and teach an incredibly fun woman how to dance. I was working, but I was living my life at the same time, and that allowed me to be a little looser than I'd been lately, not take things so seriously. It's that feeling you have when you genuinely want to come to work. After we finished our rehearsals, I became the most enviable creature in all the world, a free man in Manhattan. See you later, Ginger, I'd say already halfway out the door. Good rehearsal, girl. Practice your steps, okay? Then I would hop right on the phone with my homies. Hey, what up? What you doing? Want to grab some snackage? Fuck yeah, let's go. It was my dream life, being surrounded by my friends and family working at my dream job. Yes, there were challenges. Could she dance? No. Was she physically fit? Not really. But Ginger Z was the perfect teammate because she was intelligent as fuck, which for me was everything. We talked about every subject under the sun. I learned a lot from her and got to vent to her about situations large and small. She always gave me a measured, interesting response. As a teacher, I've only ever been as smart as my student. We developed a great, easy banter. When I first met her, I said, oh, we've got a little generation gap here. Fuck you, Ginger returned. I'm only 6 years older than you. I teased her about being a meteorologist, meanwhile secretly thinking, how dope is that? You're a weather girl, I teased her. I'm a meteorologist, she said, pretending to be offended. There's a difference. I'm a scientist. Listen, I'm just saying that you could pass aesthetically for a weather girl, because weather girls are hot, and you're hot. If you're a scientist too, good for you. Forget the physical process, because physicality was the least complicated part, since I could act a dictator and simply order Ginger to get it done. I pushed her to her physical new mom edge. I remember at the first rehearsal, we were working out some basic stuff when she put up her hand and called a halt. Hey, listen, I need to pause for a second. she said. Do you mind if I take a 10-minute break? Of course, I said. Go ahead. We were in a studio right next to the Empire State Building. She crossed over to the side of the space where we'd been dancing, sat on the couch, and unpacked an apparatus, all tubes and buttons and motors. Then she undid some buttons, slapped the apparatus aboard, and started pumping. I'm still breastfeeding, she said, explaining the obvious. I recorded a little video of her pumping and put a soundtrack over it. Technotronics Pump Up the Jam. Ginger had a good laugh about it. I realized that we had become a family. I always put forth my willingness to connect, and whenever it was reciprocated, the other person and I reached some sort of family status. I was happier than I had ever been working with a partner. Because I had been able to remain in New York during the rehearsal period, I got to celebrate my birthday surrounded by my old friends, my new friends, and all my family members. It was a milestone, my 30th. What do you want to do? Everyone asked. What do I want to do? I knew exactly. I want to go back to Brooklyn, to Brighton Beach, to the most Russian club in the city. That's where I want to go. And I want to bring all my Hollywood friends to that bitch. Rasputin, the place was called. Closed now. Rasputin, named for the mad Russian monk who mesmerized the Tsarina. Rasputin, on Coney Island Avenue near Avenue X, just blocks down from my old grade school. The Russian community of Brighton Beach by then wasn't what it once had been, but Rasputin represented the nearest thing to the old clubs where I used to dance with my brother and our partners on Friday and Saturday nights. Even though they were now more than a decade in the past, I always held those gigs close to my heart. No one could have been happier than I was then. South Brooklyn, Gravesand, Brighton Beach, the essence of where I came from. At some point early in the night at the Rasputin, I managed the toast. I know it was early because I was still able to speak. This is me, I said, sweeping my arm around the garishly decorated surroundings. This is where we came from, and this is how we celebrate 30 years. From dancing at Paradise to the paparazzi flashing photos, showing love for the kid from the five boroughs, I couldn't be more proud to come back to my roots with the new friends I've made throughout my years. Now, I got fancy friends in the city who are club owners and promoters and athletes and celebrities and actresses and meteorologists and whoever else is in the room. But I'm coming back as a little gangster with my own family and we're celebrating. Let's get this party lit. Raise a glass to Mother Brooklyn. Uh-huh. Well, I told you, I was drunk. The food was incredible. The drinks were too many, and the Hollywood imports were jaw-droppingly obsessed with the whole scene. They had never seen anything like it before. I was so excited that I took shots with everybody, to the point where I blacked out 3 hours into the party and woke up the next morning in bed at home in Manhattan. I had a little trouble recalling specifics of the night before, but I knew I had spent it in the one city I loved most, surrounded by people I adored, people I taught, and people I'd learned from. Happy 30th birthday, Vale. Ginger and I went on to have an awesome season on Dancing with the Stars. I saw her blossom as a dancer, but more than that, she changed physically, coming out of her post-pregnancy softness to get toned and fit. It was hard work for a young mother with her first child, especially for someone on television all the time. Every day Ginger appeared on a morning show in front of millions of people, and that could feel intimidating if she was insecure about how she looked. But she had the new mother glow, and she was actually more beautiful now than she'd ever been. On Dancing with the Stars, I put her all in lace for an Argentine tango that was about the sexiest thing she had ever done. The effect was not merely about the aesthetic, but about the confidence she had gained on the show, with the sultry moves of the tango showcasing her newfound poise. Across the course of the season, the audience witnessed Ginger's growth and progression, step by step, episode by episode, dance by dance. I wanted more than anything to give Ginger the best possible experience on Dancing with the Stars. Of course, with a new baby, she was already having the best time of her life. So I asked myself, How could I celebrate her recent motherhood? How could I enhance her peak moment through dance? For most memorable year theme night, I did a contemporary with her that told the story of her most memorable year. The year that she met Ben. Her husband, by the way, was excited and supportive throughout Ginger's entire season. I tried to involve him whenever possible, because when he was comfortable, she could relax and concentrate on the performance. I choreographed a dance that symbolized their meeting and his proposal. We finished with her standing in front of me, both of us reaching around to lock fingers over her belly. The camera zoomed in, the symbolism was obvious and tight, and the routine turned out to be as beautiful as Ginger and Ben's love story. At the end of the day, the most important thing to me is family, she said, in the pre-routine video package from the show, sounding much like me. My son, my husband, everything that I've come to know is home. When I do this dance, it will absolutely be a career highlight, because now it's like my career and my personal life are coming together. To be able to tell the story through dance is going to be one of the most beautiful moments of the season for me. The soundtrack was Home by Phillip Phillips, a favorite of Ginger's. Ben had once given her the framed sheet music as a present. We hung it in our first home, Ginger said. To set the scene, I put my hair up in a top knot and we both danced barefoot, wearing casual, lounging around the house type clothes. Baby Adrian was in the audience, all of 3 months old at this point, wearing little headphones like ear protectors to shield his tender little ears from the noise. After the routine, I had him brought up to the skybox, where the dancers assembled for the comments from the judges. A production assistant surprised Ginger by giving her the infant in a scene straight out of The Lion King. Here is your baby. The poor kid started crying hysterically. No one could get him to stop. I was making faces at Adrian to distract him, but he kept wailing and I started laughing. Oh my God, Ginger muttered to me. The show is going to kill me for suggesting this. The producers in the control booth were frantic. How do we get this baby to stop crying? It was a special moment, so authentic, so genuine, so lighthearted. That season with Ginger was the first time in a long time that I didn't have any romance drama, any husband drama, any drama at all. In terms of my partner, it was the most stress-free time I'd ever had. Ginger and I made it to the finals on Dancing with the Stars that season, winding up in third place. We had a lot of injuries. The process was hard, but it was also beautiful, both for her and for me. What could be better? In fact, I knew very well what could have been better. Winning a Mirror Bowl for Dear Ginger Z and knocking down a second trophy for myself just for the sake of self-validation. Could I do it again, or was it a fluke? Lori. I realize that I left you hanging somewhat, introducing you to my season 23 dance partner, Lori Hernandez, but never really detailing what happened to us on the show. Heading in to tape our first meeting segment, I walked through the entrance into the gym where she trained, and I remembered I had to take my shoes off to head onto the mats. She turned around and saw me, her face lighting up as she pranced, there was no other word for it, up to me. The expression she wore made me understand why her nickname was the human emoji. She didn't just smile, she beamed. She appeared to be a miniature powerhouse, an atomic bomb stuffed into a USA leotard. We embraced a big brother little sister hug that set the tone for our whole subsequent relationship. Her mother Wanda was there and her manager Cheryl Shade, and the whole atmosphere was one of warmth and family. A vibe I was very familiar with growing up in my own household. Hi, how you doing? I'm Val. I know who you are. I'm Lori Hernandez. Nice to meet you, Lori, I said. I know who you are too. Well, she said, looking me straight in the eyes. Are you ready to win this thing? Hey, I laughed. I love your ambition. We're gonna do our best. My close but no cigar experience with Zendaya flashed through my mind. The small sting of regret from not being able to bring home a win that season still remained with me 2 years later. We had come in second, within a hair's breadth of the championship. I felt like I had failed Zendaya as a mentor. This time I vowed it would be different. I had to be at the top of my game because the stakes weren't just the Mirror Bowl trophy. They were bigger than that. Lori Hernandez was at an age where each little influence could have an enormous impact. Why couldn't I work to create more avenues for her? Why not inspire her to give back even more than she had already given? If I did that, I thought, this young woman could change the world. Helping others should be everybody's foremost responsibility in life, and I realized it was what made me the happiest, was where I found my place. I looked at Lori and told myself this season I would be better. I was there to guide her, to help her, to lift her up where she belonged, so she could hold up that Mirror Bowl trophy. That day at the gym, I gained another small insight into the life of Lori Hernandez, courtesy of a scene that I was not sure I was supposed to witness. I passed by the office of Lori's longtime gymnastics coach, Maggie, and caught a glimpse of her in tears. She wept in the privacy of her office, but I saw her and understood immediately. My arrival on the scene represented a rite of passage. One phase of Lori's life was ending and another, more adult one, was beginning. This woman had been by Lori's side for years, and perhaps she felt someone was taking away a precious diamond of a child. The end of an era can be wrenching. I respectfully tried to keep my distance, but I knew the heartache she was probably feeling. I knew the transition wasn't going to be easy for Lori either, despite what she said about loving the show and dreaming about being a contestant. I started watching it from the very first season when I was 5, she told me, making me feel every minute of my age. Damn, I'm old, I said. And damn, the show is old too. Just as her coach's life may have been changing, so too, of course, was Lori's. She was leaving the world that she knew behind, a kind of upheaval that I was familiar with, having left the competition world to do Dancing with the Stars. Lori was coming off the biggest result of her career, an incredible achievement for her and her coach. She came home from the Olympics and immediately went into rehearsal with me. Her commitment to Dancing with the Stars would be only for 3 months, but its symbolism made the time frame feel more extreme than that. The afternoon opened the door to an incredible partnership and a lasting friendship. I felt something of a mysterious transition, a passing of the torch. My time wasn't up for sure, not by any stretch of the imagination. But even though I was only a few years older, okay, maybe like 14 years older, Lori seemed to me like an avatar of a new generation. I would get a chance to teach somebody, someone ready to learn how to dance correctly, who knew how to take guidance and coaching. I could teach her things that were taught to me. I never had the chance to be an older brother, but I would get to be one with her. All the experience that I had gained over the course of my 30 years, I would now get to share with the 16-year-old standing before me, a vision of awesomeness bottled up in a gymnastic outfit. What I saw in her was not just an athlete, which was what the world saw in her, but a superstar. When I spoke to Lori, I came to understand the depth of her intellect and even wisdom. Not many 16-year-old girls thought like her, and her maturity served as a testament to her parents and the way they raised her. I saw an opportunity for me to bring out the best in what already was a pretty awesome kid. But I never did treat her like a kid. I knew there was a difference between being young and being a child. I wanted her to make sure that she knew the difference too, that just because she was 16 didn't mean she couldn't have the ambition to change the world. She didn't have to wait. She could do it now, today, at 16. Not when she grew up. She didn't have the excuse some kids use. When I grow up, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. You don't have to wait to grow up to do any of those things. You could do them right now. Our background served as a kind of common denominator, and I was able to relate to her right off the bat. My experience as a national and a world champion in competitive dance, and my pedigree as a high-caliber dance coach, gave my voice authority. If I was just another Hollywood kid teaching her how to dance, we probably wouldn't have had the same relationship. The first day at the gym, she quite literally showed me the ropes. We had a little race up the climbing rope, and I wasn't even close. She was up and back down while I was still barely halfway up. I'm going to blame it on the age difference. I told her, laughing as I sheepishly dropped back to the floor. I called Dina Katz immediately. Thank you so much, I said. She's incredible. I'm grateful for the opportunity.